As mentioned previously, at the ASCO plenary session, a landmark GOG trial was presented on the use of bevacizumab with chemotherapy in the upfront stage 3-4 post-op setting. I met with Dr. Robert Berger, the investigator who presented GOG-218, and he began our conversation by commenting on the biologic background of the study.
We know that ovarian cancers are disease processes that really combine several anatomic sites, including the ovary itself, the peritoneum, and the fallopian tube, and that these tumors taken together tend to overexpress vascular endothelial growth factor, which is a central promoter of tumor angiogenesis, and that bevacizumab, which is known to many of you as a VEGF-neutralizing monoclonal antibody, has demonstrated remarkable single-agent activity in patients with recurrent ovarian cancer in at least two phase two trials. And of course, while those trials were being conducted with single-agent therapy, the drug bevacizumab had been approved for the treatment of patients with metastatic non-gynecologic tumors, including colorectal and non-small cell lung cancer at that point. So this GOG phase 3 trial, GOG-218, was designed to evaluate bevacizumab in the frontline treatment setting. The trial was an international placebo-controlled double-blind phase 3 trial, which enrolled patients with stage 3 and 4 ovarian, primary peritoneal, and fallopian tube cancer established through standard surgery with maximal attempt at cytoreduction. And then patients that were eligible were randomized evenly to one of three arms. The control arm, including carboplatin and paclitaxel at standard dosage and schedule for 6 cycles with placebo, followed by placebo maintenance for an additional 16 cycles unless evidence of progression or unacceptable side effects.
Can I just ask, I was curious about the placebo control. Does that mean that the people in the arm 1 and 2 who didn't get maintenance out to, I guess it was 15 months total, that they got placebo injection for 12 months or whatever?
Correct.
Wow.
So this was, in a sense, a very pure trial. It wasn't a problem, really, in terms of accrual, but it was perceived to be potentially a problem. But in terms of preserving the clinical endpoints of the trial in terms of efficacy, and even looking at the distribution of adverse events, I think that the placebo control was an important component.
Yeah, no, I think it was an awesome thing to actually execute, but it is amazing to think about the fact that 2 out of 3 of these people were getting placebo injections for a year.
They were, unless they, of course, progressed.
Sure.
Or had safety signals that were beyond acceptable. So essentially, with this type of treatment program, we were looking at a cytotoxic phase, which was the first 6 cycles, and then a maintenance phase of 16 cycles unless disease progression was documented or unacceptable toxicity was documented. So arm 2 essentially evaluated concurrent bevacizumab with cytotoxic therapy using bevacizumab at 15 milligrams per kilogram, which was the dose that was established to be effective in 2 previous phase 2 studies, administered cycles 2 through 6. And the reason that either placebo or active drug was initiated during cycle 2 was to prevent wound complications, since these patients were treated in the postoperative period. And of course, with arm 2, the maintenance phase was exactly the same as arm 1, which contained only placebo. And then arm 3 evaluated concurrent bevacizumab followed by maintenance bevacizumab, so that all these patients received the same exact cytotoxic regimen, initiated bevacizumab during cycle 2. The idea in terms of the trial design was to look at extended concurrent plus extended therapy beyond the standard 6 cycles of primary therapy versus standard therapy, and then also look at concurrent bevacizumab with no maintenance compared to placebo. The trial relied on a sample size of 1,800 patients to have a 90% power of detecting a progression-free survival advantage with a hazard ratio of 0.77 or better in analyzing progression-free survival between arm 3 and arm 1 or arm 2 versus arm 1. And then the secondary endpoints included overall survival, safety, and some exploratory studies that we're doing in the lab, as well as quality of life. So these patients were those with a postoperative diagnosis of stage 3 or 4 disease, no prior chemotherapy. They were enrolled within 1 to 12 weeks after initial surgery and had the standard inclusion and exclusion criteria based on prior trials with bevacizumab. The trial was conducted, enrolled patients between October 2005 and June of 2009, and involved 1,873 patients. Some important protocol amendments, one was that initially the trial enrolled only patients with stage 3 suboptimally debulked and patients with stage 4 disease. And eventually, because of issues related to competing trials that were no longer competing, midway through the enrollment period, the trial allowed inclusion of patients with optimally debulked stage 3 disease, but all patients had to have at least macroscopic residual disease, meaning that none of these patients were completely resectable despite maximal attempt. The other important modification to the trial was the change in the primary endpoint to progression-free survival. And this was done for two reasons. One, because there was a consensus conference by the Gynecologic Cancer Intergroup, which occurred in 2004 and was published in 2005, essentially stating that the primary endpoint of progression-free survival in frontline ovarian cancer trials was probably more relevant than overall survival or more meaningful as long as several criteria were upheld, including protecting the validity of progression-free survival and at least analyzing overall survival in some meaningful way. The median follow-up of the patient population was 17.4 months in those who were alive. The baseline clinical and pathologic characteristics were evenly distributed across the study groups. All the known prognostic factors pretty much matched across these groups. At the time of the analysis of progression-free survival, which was essentially the primary analysis triggered by a pre-specified number of events, about 20% of the patients had completed all 22 cycles of therapy, more so in the concurrent plus maintenance arm. So arm 3, there were 24% of patients had completed all 22 cycles versus 15% in the control group. There were also, on average, about 15% of patients on treatment at the time of the analysis, all of them in the maintenance phase. The majority of patients had discontinued study treatment, at least two-thirds of the patients, and mostly for disease progression. There was a slightly greater number of patients who discontinued study treatment based on adverse events in arms 2 and 3 versus arm 1, but across the board, the numbers were 14 and 15% for arm 2 and 3 versus 11% for arm 1. There were very few deaths under 2% related to adverse events. I think for adverse events, if you look at the adverse events data, these are very similar to what has been seen or have been seen in prior phase 3 studies of metastatic non-gynecologic cancers. One of the things that was of interest to many of us who have been treating patients with bevacizumab and have been involved as investigators on prior trials was the relative incidence of gastrointestinal perforation, which was a safety signal in some prior studies. It turns out that the frequency of gastrointestinal perforation was under 3% in all the arms. It was 2.8 and 2.6% in arms 2 and 3 versus 1.2% in arm 1, and this is very consistent with prior trials. The remaining safety data are consistent. Interestingly, the incidence of venous and arterial thrombotic events was really no different across the arms, and that was a little bit unexpected.
Right now, before we go on in terms of the trial, just in terms of these really important findings here, right now, how do you put together the bowel perforation story?
Well, I think that based on the collective data for patients with recurrent disease, it seems like the risk is greater than what one would see in frontline therapy. And so we're estimating that risk would be about 5% in patients with recurrent ovarian cancer. We don't really understand why those patients are at higher risk. You saw in this study where you had very controlled data in the frontline setting that there was a 1.2% baseline rate in the control group. And so I think having controlled data is important because it does suggest that this is an event that does occur in patients with this disease, and it's probably higher than in other disease sites, even though it runs in the range of 1 to 1.5%. The risk factors or mechanisms related to GI perforation have still yet to be elucidated. We're actually conducting a study within a study. So in GOG-218, we actually collected medical data at baseline on all of these patients, and specifically targeting hypothetical risk factors such as history of inflammatory bowel disease, use of corticosteroids, known vascular disease, whether or not the patients had a gastrointestinal resection at the time of their ovarian cancer surgery. Unfortunately, I don't have the results of that analysis at this point, but hopefully within the next few months, we'll be able to analyze that and then report it at a subsequent meeting. But I think some of the hypothetical issues you talked about, for example, we know that ovarian cancer is associated with the development of functional and structural problems with the bowel, leading to either functional or mechanical obstruction of the bowel. And obstruction of the intestine is known to be a primary risk factor for perforation in general. So when you add an agent that has a mechanism that may contribute to that, I think you're essentially pushing the event rate up. But how that happens, I think we need good preclinical studies. I've been arguing that we should be doing that for many years, but I think the clinical findings from GOG-218 based on this prospective analysis will be important.
Now, another thing that you commented on that is discussed in all the cancers that bevacizumab is used is this question of arterial and venous events. And every time I look at that, I still can't really figure out exactly what's going on or what the risk factors is and how much the risk is. You didn't see that at all. What do you think the reason is? Now, your patients, the median age was around 60, maybe a little bit younger, I don't know, than, say, some of the colon trials, maybe some of the other trials. Any hypotheses about why you didn't see it?
I would think that this is a population that would be very similar, if not maybe a little older, than most of the studies. I think specifically, if you look at the breast cancer studies, this would be an older population. Probably compared to the colorectal studies, this might be even a slightly older population. It's actually not clear why the event rate, for example, for arterial thrombotic events was 0.8, 0.7, 0.7%, and for venous events was in the range of 5 to 6%, really no significant difference across the arms. We would have expected a higher arterial thrombotic event rate in the bevacizumab-treated patients. Still don't understand the mechanism. We do know a little bit about risk factors, including age, as you pointed out, pre-existing arteriovascular disease or cardiovascular disease. We were obviously careful about excluding patients with history of significant vascular events, and that probably decreased the event rate overall compared to what one would have expected and may have decreased the likelihood in seeing a difference. And maybe in trials that are conducted in the future, we'll start to see that more because clinicians that enter patients onto these trials will be more aware of prior history and excluding patients that have an increased intrinsic risk.
Another thing I was kind of curious when I saw your slide there with the patient age, just as a side light, but am I correct in saying you had people who were in their late 80s, 86, 87, 88 in the study?
Oh, yes, absolutely. And so it was sort of across the board.
Interesting. One other question about the side effects issue. Just kind of curious, getting back to this extraordinary situation where you had people getting placebo, you know, infusions. When you think about something like, you know, antibody like trastuzumab, for example, in breast cancer, you see people in terms of, other than the injection, people kind of feel like, in general, these people have the same quality of life. Do you think you could tell who was getting the placebo and who was getting the actual bevacizumab?
I think maybe in 10% of patients, just based on clinical experience and symptomatic AEs versus asymptomatic AEs. I think the only biological or expressible effect that patients would notice is whether their physician told them that their blood pressure was going up. Really, other than that, there would have been no way for patients to know what they were receiving based on what's been reported in patients receiving single-agent bevacizumab in the treatment of recurrent disease.
Another thing that you see in the other tumors, not that it's necessarily that critical, but it is noticed clinically, and I'm curious what was seen. I'm not sure I saw it there, was the issue of nosebleeds?
Mm-hmm. Yes. Well, low-grade nosebleeds are certainly more common in patients receiving bevacizumab. And unfortunately, I don't have the data on grade 1 and 2 bleeding. But for more substantial bleeding, the event rate was 2% or less. It was slightly higher in patients receiving bevacizumab than patients receiving in the control arm. But the event rate was about 2% or less.
Right.
Overall. So, yeah, I guess that would be one way that a patient could know, but I think that the incidence rate is still, even grade 1 to 2 events, is still probably in the 10% range or less. So that could theoretically affect the clinicians or patients being, I guess, blinded. But since all those events were reported in the three treatment groups, one could not tell for sure.
How about efficacy?
Well, efficacy, essentially, when progression-free survival was analyzed, what we found is that there was a statistically significant improvement in progression-free survival for patients receiving concurrent followed by maintenance bevacizumab compared to patients receiving standard therapy. And the proportional difference was, you can look at it in two ways. There was a 28% reduction in the risk of progression for arm 3 versus arm 1, and a shift in the median progression-free survival from 10.3 months in arm 1, the control arm, to 14.1 months in arm 3. You can also look at it as a 39% improvement in the likelihood of remaining progression-free. There was a small difference in progression-free survival between arm 2 and arm 1 that was not statistically significant, even though there's some separation in the progression-free survival curves between those two groups. When we looked at subset analyses that included all the known major prognostic factors, the results were remarkably consistent across subgroups when comparing progression-free survival in arm 3 to arm 1.
So what were your conclusions and the conclusions of the GOG about this data set?
Well, the conclusions were that the trial met its primary objective in the frontline treatment of patients with advanced disease, in that there was a significant progression-free survival advantage in treating patients with concurrent followed by maintenance bevacizumab combined with standard chemotherapy compared with standard chemotherapy alone. The interpretation of the survival data at this point is limited because only 24% of patients across the study have died of disease. There were somewhat fewer death events in arm 3 versus the other arms, but the median overall survivals at this point are not statistically different. And the other thing about that is that because patients were unblinded at the time of disease progression, we can't control for the use of bevacizumab in subsequent lines of therapy, and there's a high potential of crossover, essentially neutralizing any effect we might see on overall survival. And that's one of the problems with having a progression-free survival endpoint, but it's very difficult to keep patients unblinded at the time of disease progression, which you would need to do to maintain an overall survival endpoint.
Now, do you have any data, because I didn't see you presented it, on whether or not patients who didn't get Bev or got it only during the chemo got it subsequently?
We actually are unable to tell at this point. The best I can say it, because in the GOG, our MO is to collect specific data on second-line therapy, but not tertiary and beyond, which is a limitation. I can only say that before the results were released to the public in terms of the top-line data, about 10% of patients across the board had received bevacizumab in second-line therapy. We're going to try to collect data on patients to get an idea of what the degree of crossover, in fact, was and will be as time goes on. But it's difficult just because of reporting issues and the ability to collect that data over time once you've completed the treatment phase.
You know, often you see trials that have progression-free survival. It's not mature enough to look at survival. Sometimes they're modest. And, you know, you say, and this kind of gets into, is it worth actually giving to a patient outside of a study? Well, if I'm going to delay progression for 4 months, but they're not going to live any longer, is it worth the cost or whatever?
So here's a way to look at it that I think would be helpful. I think you always need to look at the methods that are used to assess disease and the risk level of the population that's actually studied. So if you look at this patient population in GOG-218, the median progression-free survival for the standard treatment arm was 10 months, which was a lot lower than what was expected. So we had anticipated a PFS of 14 months at the median, based on historical information from recent phase 3 trials that were enrolling patients with similar eligibility criteria. I think there are two reasons why we saw that. Number one, if you look at the breakdown in terms of stage and tumor debulking status, 2/3 of the patients on this trial had either stage 3 suboptimal disease or stage 4 disease, which essentially elevates the risk of progression right there. Also, all patients had to have macroscopic residual disease at the completion of initial surgery, so it excluded patients with stage 3 tumors that had been completely resected. The other important factor is that since CA-125 was used as part of the determination of progression-free survival, that essentially implements a much more sensitive tool in tracking disease. So both of those factors shift for the control group to the left. So when you look at a 4-month shift in the median from 10 months to 14 months, I think the proportional difference is important because you need to look at the risk level of the population. So the hazard ratio for this trial was 0.717 when you compare those two groups. And that's similar to phase 3 trials that were positive for overall survival when overall survival was the primary endpoint. So if you look at the GOG-172 intraperitoneal trial that was reported in the New England Journal of Medicine that showed a 16-month improvement in overall survival, the hazard ratio for that trial was actually 0.8 for progression-free survival, which was higher than this trial. We saw the same thing with GOG-111, which was the initial trial reported in the New England Journal in 1996, establishing paclitaxel as part of standard therapy. That demonstrated a 38% improvement in progression-free survival, similar to what we saw in this trial. And the recent Japanese GOG novel trial evaluating low-dose weekly paclitaxel versus standard paclitaxel in primary therapy, the hazard ratio for that trial in terms of progression-free survival was 0.71, and all of those trials were positive for overall survival. But there were no issues related to crossover for any of those trials. So I think while we can talk about this as a 4-month advantage in median progression-free survival, if you look at the whole progression-free survival curve, if you factor in the risk level of the population and then look at some of the other trials where we met a similar bar, it may be that we need to look beyond that 4-month number.
Well, also, you know, again, the idea, you know, I think of a clinician kind of thinking about this from the point of view of a patient or a patient trying to think about it. And, the, you know, the quantitative numbers do affect the way people think. But if somebody says to me, I'm going to give you a therapy with pretty low risk that maybe is going to extend your survival for a year or maybe more if you really try to factor in the crossover complication. You know, that's from a human point of view, an extra year or two is not inconsequential. Not that we know that in this situation, but it seems like it's possible, which I didn't even realize.
No, I agree. And I would also take it one step further and say, you know, this is one major clinical trial, and there are several that are in progress that are analyzing similar questions. But it's an important step in building the science of what's happening with this agent and the approach of targeting a growth factor that's important in the disease progression process. It's a first step. we showed that the maintenance strategy is important, but we didn't push the envelope. So I would imagine that successive trials would evaluate treatment to progression as opposed to a fixed number of cycles versus a fixed number of cycles, and look at overall survival even more carefully or more specifically. The other thing that we know is that there's a trial, a very similar trial, which is being conducted in Europe, which is called ICON 7, evaluating bevacizumab in the frontline setting. It's a slightly different patient population and a two-arm trial without a placebo, but I think it's going to yield important information, and we should see results from that trial later in this year. There are also two phase 3 trials being conducted in second-line therapy in platinum-sensitive recurrent patients, which are randomized phase 3 trials. So if we see consistency among these trials, it's going to speak to the incorporation of bevacizumab in standard therapy. Right now, I think it would be important to discuss the results of this trial with patients and explain the impact and offer this as one option for treatment within standard care. But certainly, treatment needs to be individualized.
From your own clinical point of view, how do you think the risk-benefit stacks up for most patients in this situation right now?
I think for most patients, the benefit-to-risk ratio is favorable for treating patients that would have met eligibility for the trial. I would be careful in trying to state that this should be done in patients that would not have met eligibility criteria, so it's important that patients not be enrolled if they would have been excluded based on contraindications, based on the presence of active bowel obstruction, having earlier stage disease at this point. We will know from ICON 7, which is enrolling patients with earlier stage disease, whether it would be reasonable to recommend this. We also need to take into account that there may be patients that are treated with neoadjuvant chemotherapy before surgery, which I would estimate involves about 10 to 15% of the patient population right now. We can't really extrapolate these data to those patients because all of the patients enrolled in GOG-218 had surgery before they were enrolled. So we haven't established the safety and feasibility of treating patients in the neoadjuvant setting with this approach. And finally, patients who would be candidates for intraperitoneal chemotherapy, which is also considered a standard option in patients with optimally debulked advanced disease, that should also be presented to patients as an option for treatment. And the safety and efficacy of using bevacizumab in the setting of intraperitoneal chemotherapy has not been established, but it's being evaluated in a phase 3 trial conducted by the GOG.
What about sort of indirectly comparing? Obviously, the side effects, et cetera, are quite different, but indirectly comparing the efficacy of intraperitoneal therapy to adding Bev?
I am concerned about the safety in treating patients with intraperitoneal chemotherapy using the regimen that was found to be effective, for example, in GOG-172, which included cisplatin and paclitaxel. And the relative toxicity of that regimen compared to intravenous therapy alone was substantial. I think if you look at the relative safety, that the effect might be partially neutralized, but there was an overall survival advantage reported for that trial and two previous trials, and that can't be ignored. I think right now, with the current intraperitoneal trial, we're trying to refine that a bit and to come up with a regimen slash solution to the toxicity problem and the feasibility problems, which may allow more universal use of intraperitoneal therapy and may establish the combination of intraperitoneal chemotherapy in the setting of bevacizumab as a new standard.
You mentioned the issue of duration of bevacizumab, and in a sense, your study demonstrated an advantage to receiving it for 15 months as opposed to just during the chemo. And it sort of brings up the issue of the NSABP COA colon cancer study presented at ASCO last year, where there seems to have been a benefit during the year the Bev was administered.
Well, I think that it shows that, at least for the COA trial, that there is single-agent activity. In a subset of patients, they have essentially a stabilizing effect from the drug when used in a maintenance setting, and then you see a drop-off or you see progressions occur after stopping therapy. And it basically implies that longer duration use beyond a fixed number of cycles would be important to evaluate, because theoretically, when you look at progression-free survival curves like the ones reported for the COA trial or the GOG-218 trial, that if we had continued treatment beyond 16 additional cycles in patients that were tolerating therapy, that we would have maintained separation in the progression-free survival curves for a longer period of time. And we may have even seen a survival advantage early on in looking at the data if we had designed the trial that way.
One final question. I know you referred in your presentation to all the translational work that's going to be done, which should really be exciting. What do you have to work with? You have sera, do you have tumor, and what are some of the things that you're going to look at that you're most excited to see?
We have peripheral blood samples to look at germline DNA and do genomic array analysis, looking for host factors that may be associated with a benefit that is much greater than what we would see at the median versus those that might have no benefit. And we're also examining primary tumor specimens and doing array analysis to look at signatures that may cluster with prolonged progression-free survival or no effect. And the fact that we have a good control group, I think, helps in doing those sorts of studies. The other types of research that are being done with those peripheral blood samples, serum samples, and tumor samples will be based on existing studies that have been done in ovarian cancer to look at the effect of VEGF polymorphisms and some other biomarkers related to angiogenesis that at this point have only been considered prognostic but may also be predictive. I think it's also important to note that we have conducted a formal quality of life analysis in the context of GOG-218, and having results that include not only the treatment phase but the post-treatment phase will be important in comparing outcomes among these treatment arms.
Why don't we talk about one of your patients? How about the woman with the BRCA mutation?
Yeah, sure. This patient is 46 years old, had a strong family history of breast and ovarian cancer without really understanding that that was an issue, developed a symptomatic left-sided pelvic mass, went to surgery and had evidence of an ovarian cancer with a 10-centimeter mass that was invading through the sigmoid colon. She really had no other evidence of intraperitoneal disease. Most of her other disease was retroperitoneal, involving multiple pelvic and periaortic nodes. So she underwent a radical resection of her ovarian malignancy with a standard ovarian cancer operation, but including pelvic and periaortic lymphadenectomy and a en bloc partial sigmoid colectomy, and had no evidence of macroscopic residual disease at the time of her surgery. She actually underwent 6 cycles of intravenous paclitaxel and carboplatin. She was presented with the option of intraperitoneal chemotherapy, but one of the major risks for serious complications with intraperitoneal therapy is gastrointestinal complications related to sigmoid colon resections performed at the time of initial surgery. So in those patients, many times there's a delay in the use of intraperitoneal chemotherapy after at least the first cycle in clinical practice. The other issue is that she really didn't have significant intraperitoneal involvement. Almost all of her disease was retroperitoneal in terms of the residual disease, so it was felt that systemic therapy with a regimen that would be better tolerated and as the community standard would be used. She was then evaluated and found to have a germline mutation in BRCA1. None of her family members had been tested. Subsequently, some of her sisters were tested and found to be positive and are undergoing preventive surgeries. Some of her family members refused to be tested. But this illustrates the point that women who have significant family history of breast and ovarian cancer may still not have an awareness of the relationship to the hereditary breast ovarian cancer syndrome and the need for sophisticated risk assessment, because their disease can be prevented almost completely with a proactive approach utilizing surgical prevention.
Now, in this particular patient, how are you approaching her breasts?
So this patient has been through a counseling process related to breast cancer prevention And so one of the treatment options is, of course, bilateral total mastectomy, which was presented. The BRCA1 germline mutation carriers tend to develop triple negative breast cancers, which are more aggressive than the tumors that are diagnosed in patients with BRCA2 alterations, which are more commonly estrogen receptor, progestin receptor positive, HER2 new negative. So with that in the background, the patient has actually elected to go on to hormonal prevention with an anti-estrogen agent and frequent screening using both mammography and MRI as opposed to having prophylactic surgery, which is obviously the more effective choice.
Now, what would you estimate this woman's chances of cure from the ovarian cancer?
Well, she has an advantage with her germline mutation. These patients have somewhat better prognosis, and the fact that she was completely resected probably gives her a 50% chance of a 5-year survival.
One final question about this patient. If she were to present today, and assuming there weren't any obstructions to getting it paid for, would you be adding in bevacizumab to her carbopaclitaxel?
I think I would have to have a discussion about the fact she would not have been eligible for GOG-218 based on the fact that she had no macroscopic residual disease, even though she had stage 3C ovarian cancer. But I still would have counseled her that that would be a very reasonable option and presented her with the data with the fact that we would be extrapolating from the trial in some ways. I would be a little bit concerned about the fact that she had a recent sigmoid colon resection. However, with a negative margin, it would be reasonable to consider because many patients on the GOG-218 trial had bowel resections. I'd like to see the data on the GI perforation rate in patients who had colon resections versus not before really effectively counseling this patient. The interesting thing about this type of patient is she might be one who 5 to 10 years from now would be treated with a platinum-containing regimen with an anti-VEGF inhibitor and a PARP inhibitor. Hmm. And indeed, there are actually feasibility trials looking at all four drugs in combination in the frontline setting right now.
Have you had patients in your own practice who've received PARP inhibitors in clinical trials?
We have at Fox Chase, but not in my personal clinical practice.
You know, in breast cancer, we've heard about impressive responses and in patients who've got BRCA mutations, actually the single agent PARP inhibitor is the agent olaparib. Is it your take that the responses that are seen with these BRCA tumors to monotherapy with PARP inhibitors are clinically meaningful?
I think it's too early to tell, but I think the anecdotal information I've received is that some remarkable responses have been observed. I just don't know how to put that into a frame of reference in a statistical sense.
So I guess I'm thinking about your idea of what's going to happen in the future, and I can imagine that you're going to do your profile on the tumor, and you're going to look at the sera for their SNPs and all that stuff coming out of your study and maybe other studies to see whether to give them bevacizumab or some other anti-VEGF agent, and then we'll do the BRCA profile that you talked about before to see in the non-BRCA patients whether or not they ought to get a PARP inhibitor. And hopefully that's, do you think that's where we're going to be?
I think that's the wave of the future. I think that we'll have to more and more individualize treatment. And it's important because when we start to combine agents without applying the biology, the information we have from tumor biology, we'll run into a number of problems. One is that we'll be using ineffective agents that are costly and have associated toxicity. And it's infeasible to use maybe more than 4 agents at a time in treating a patient with frontline therapy. So I think we're going to have to establish panels of treatment menus that are driven by good science showing predictive validity.